This is a rebroadcast of Locavore from the CFRU archives. Locavore airs live every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM.
CFRU archive.
This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, broadcast out of Guelph, Ontario, on CFRU 93.3 FM. Today I'll be speaking with Jackson Landers, who is known as the Locavore Hunter. And Jackson is an author, a hunting instructor, a guide, a teacher, and an activist for local food and hunting issues. I'm talking with Jackson Landers, the Locavore Hunter. He's got a blog, and it's on blogspot.com.
You can go to jacksonlanders.com, and that'll point you over to it.
Okay, jacksonlanders.com will point you over to it, and it's called The Locavore Hunter. Okay, so, Jackson, can you tell me a bit about yourself, please?
Sure. I am a full-time author, hunting instructor, guide, teacher, and a local food hunting activist. I did not grow up doing this. I think when you look at the typical sort of person who might be writing about hunting, and I probably don't really fit that mold very well. I actually grew up in a vegetarian household. I didn't eat chicken until I was probably somewhere around 12 years old, and it wasn't until around then that I actually ate a hamburger either. So I didn't really grow up with this. I did do a little bit of fishing when I was a kid, and learned how to gut a fish, and that gave me some context for hunting as an adult. But I started doing this in my mid-20s for a lot of different reasons, mostly that I didn't really feel comfortable handling meat, actually. Like when I was cooking, but I didn't want to touch it with my hands. And there came a point where I thought, this is kind of weird that I'm willing to eat this, but I don't want to be, you know, directly confronted with the reality of what it is. And I thought to myself, if I can't, hunt, butcher, and cook my own meat myself, if I can't go out and do that at least once, then maybe I don't have any business eating meat. And so I set out to do it with deer. I started hunting deer. I set out to learn how to do that. And as it turned out, I was pretty okay with it. And it all sort of snowballed from there.
So I find it really interesting that you talk about not wanting to touch the meat. Are you talking about even like making a hamburger to go on the grill?
Oh yeah. Like I wouldn't have touched, before I became a hunter, like I didn't want to touch raw meat with my fingers, you know. Like if I could cook a steak by picking it up with some tongs or something, I would do that.
Okay.
And I actually have to say, I still feel a little bit uncomfortable handling, I'm a little bit grossed out handling factory meat, like, you know, meat that might come from a grocery store. When I kill something myself, I know that it's safe. I know how the meat has been handled. I know it's been kept to the right temperature. I'm not worried about, E. coli as much. Something that came from the grocery store, I have no idea what happened to it.
Right.
So I do still feel a little bit queasy handling factory meat. There's no way I would have made a hamburger and, like, rolled up a patty with my hands, you know. I wouldn't have done that.
Okay, so you talk about invasive species. What do you consider the most invasive game species to be in North America, and why are they invasive?
Well, okay, game species, I don't know if this is part of your intent in the question, but of course game species in most states has a specific legal and regulatory meaning, and there is some overlap between game species and invasive species.
Okay.
You know, a game species, for example, here in Virginia, game species would be considered things like deer and doves, and to a certain extent we started to see some elk here, and those are going to be considered game species and have special tighter regulations and rules for them. There is some overlap between the two groups. For example, ringneck pheasants, actually, those are regulated usually as a game species, but of course they're invasive. They're native to Asia and were brought here by way of Europe.
Okay.
So that there's an invasive species. Pigeons, the common pigeon, that is a was considered a game species for a long time in Europe, but now it's just sort of an invasive pest. So those are certainly a problem. So
right.
do you want to stick with that definition?
No, not. I'm just interested. So there is the overlap. I'm actually interested with the elk. Now, is the elk from elk farms and they've escaped, or why are they?
No, elk are native to North America.
In Eastern North America. That's what I'm sort of wondering.
Although here's a funny way you could look at, elk. This is just one way of direction to look at the concepts of what's a native versus an invasive species. You know, a lot of people don't realize human beings have been in North America longer than elk have. You know, elk have only been here for between 9,000 and 11,000 years, and Homo sapiens have probably been here a lot longer than that. Elk just came over from the land bridge over what is now the Bering Sea,
yeah.
And they until very recently were considered the same species as European red deer. And now we think of elk as a native species. They've been here for a long time. In one sense, human beings have been around here longer than they have. In terms of what is an invasive species, a good working definition is something that Homo sapiens have brought here. I think that's probably a pretty good definition, something that Homo sapiens have brought here and is expanding its numbers and range and in some way disrupting the natural ecosystem. I mean, there's all sorts of stuff that makes for good eating in that group. Feral pigs, you know, they're something that's very easy to cook with that we find in a lot of different places in North America. As far as something that might be in your backyard is concerned, European starlings, which are everywhere, you know, those aren't bad to eat, and you can catch them in traps, and there's literally millions of them.
Okay. Now, I'm just wondering about the elk because I lived in Western Canada for a number of years, and I know that they're there in large populations in certain areas, but I was unaware that they're that far east as far as Virginia goes.
Yeah, they are. Actually, a lot of people don't realize that both elk and bison are native to the eastern states, and even to Virginia. The elk were the last of the native elk in Virginia were extirpated about 100 years ago, and the last bison here in Virginia on the East Coast was killed actually by Daniel Boone's youngest son in it was right around 1800. It was within a few years one way or another of that. Bison were very common in a lot of the eastern states at the time that the first European colonists arrived, but there was low-hanging fruit in terms of things to shoot and eat.
Right.
And so we came to think about bison as a Great Plains species, and they certainly were out there in high numbers. But we had a lot of bison and a lot of elk. And in the last 40 years or so, there have been a lot of reintroduction efforts to put elk back in the eastern states. There are places in the world where elk are invasive and they don't belong. They've been brought to New Zealand, for example. They really don't belong there. And there are a lot of places where they've been brought to that they don't belong. But the eastern United States is part of their natural range.
Okay. Now, let's say non-regulated, non-game species, what do you consider to be the most prominent invasive species?
Pigs would be the classic one. In most states, and I think there's some Canadian provinces that have some problems with feral pigs. Usually on private land, it's just open season year round, and you can take them at any point. And the beauty of hunting pigs is that, you know, unlike a lot of invasive species, there's not much of a reach in terms of figuring out the cuisine for it. We've got armadillos in a lot of the American South that don't belong here. Anywhere north of the Rio Grande, armadillos are invasive. But pigs, people already know how to cook with pork, you know, so that's something very very easy to work with.
Right.
So I think that's certainly a classic one. I've got to say, in terms of sheer ease of butchering, you know, in terms of something that's just very quick to turn into food, believe it or not, iguanas work really well, which I don't think are much of a problem in Canada. But in Florida, there are both green iguanas and black spiny tail iguanas have been brought from Central America, and they are the black spiny tails especially are a huge problem. And these guys, they look like little dinosaurs running all over the place, and it is a little bit of a challenge, I think, to some people emotionally saying, I'm going to eat this lizard, because we don't eat a lot of reptiles in the West. But actually, they're easier to butcher than chickens, because all the meat is in the legs and the tail. You don't even really need to gut them. You know, it takes you, you know, no more than 5 minutes to turn those guys into food if you want to. So,
really?
It's for people in Florida, it's something. It's like a chicken right there in the backyard that you can eat very quickly.
What do they taste like?
That's a cliche, but they taste like chicken, although the texture is different. Most reptiles I've found taste like chicken, although the texture is usually more like crab. Okay. So that's. But you could use it as a straight substitute for chicken in most cases. You don't need special invasive armadillo or invasive iguana recipes. You can just use any recipe for chicken, and it's going to work fine.
Okay. Now I have to ask, being someone who's been involved in food science, and protein is protein, but has there been an analysis done on the game that you've actually caught and used? Have you taken it to any labs to compare it to, let's say, chicken or ground beef for that matter?
You mean for cholesterol content and that sort of thing?
Yes.
No, I haven't been in a financial position to take it to any lab.
Yeah.
So I couldn't tell you, you know, what the relative density is of protein and so forth.
Okay.
But I will say that, you know, iguanas and all the species that I've been pursuing like this, you know, none of these things are really completely original to use as a food source. It's maybe original in North America, but, you know, people have been eating iguanas for thousands of years in Central America, and, you know, if there was any kind of danger, it would have become evident by now.
Right. You've just killed a deer or you've just killed a goose. What immediate steps do you have to take in order to prevent microbial contamination, bacterial contamination?
You want to cool it down as quickly as possible. That's the key, and that can mean different things for those different species. With a goose, I think you want to get it gutted very quickly, and that's not really hard to do. There's you'll feel the soft part of the abdomen. Just think of the part of a chicken where you can see they've cut it open. You make an incision and you just reach in there and pull everything out. It's going to be unpleasant. Usually, if you're hunting geese, you're usually near water, so you can wash up afterwards. It's not that bad. A rubber glove is a good idea. Any kind of bird, you can find salmonella in it, and that's true for chicken at the grocery store too. But you want to get it gutted very quickly, and then if you've got some ice handy maybe to pack in that body cavity, that's going to be useful. If you're hunting in warm weather, which a lot of places have a September goose season, so it can be rather warm then, bear in mind you've got that layer of insulating down wrapped around the goose. It helps keep it warm. So you might want, in some situations, if it's real hot, you might want to get it plucked right away. But if you can put some ice in that body cavity, that's going to help. One way or another, you want to cool that meat down. With deer, you know, it's the same. It can be the same sort of deal where, you know, if you want to cool it down, so that can mean gutting it right away. On the other hand, if you're not planning to eat any of that organ meat, you know, some people like to eat liver and kidneys, other people don't. If you're not going to eat that organ meat, I'll tell you one thing that I encourage a lot of my students to do, and what I teach them in my classes, is so that they don't have to go out and buy a pickup truck if they don't already own one in order to hunt. I teach them that when they go hunting, take a cooler, a small like chest type cooler on wheels, and leave it in the car. If they get a deer, go and get the cooler, and you can strip the meat off the deer in the field right there and put it in the cooler. Now, in some places that won't be legal, because there are some states and some provinces where they still require that you take the whole deer into a check station for them to have a look at it when you tag it after you kill it. But mm-hmm. those rules are gradually disappearing, where they're just saying we can check it by phone or something. So in that case, you can go ahead and you can quarter off all of the meat right there and put it in that cooler without gutting it. So you're going to leave a rib cage full of organs, and that can be a much faster way of cooling the meat down. Then you can just dump your ice on top of it, and you're ready to go. So the bottom line is get it cool as quickly as possible. Don't let it get contaminated with digestive material. Certainly if you're going to gut the animal, then try not to cut into the intestines in the stomach. Try to remove those intact so that the bacteria in there isn't getting all over your meat.
Right.
So try to keep it clean and try to cool it down.
So when you leave whatever's left in the field, certainly there'll be other predators and other animals that will take care of what you leave.
Yeah, uh-huh. Nature is very efficient at the disposal of animal protein. But although, you know, what you would do would vary depending on where you're hunting. If you're hunting in a national forest in the middle of nowhere, you're half a mile from the nearest road, you're not on the trail, yeah, I think it's perfect. Or if you're on your own land or a friend's land who's said it's okay, then yeah, go ahead and just, you can leave the gut pile or the skeleton with the gut still in it, and that's going to be gone pretty quickly. The scavenger is going to pick it up. On the other hand, if you're hunting in, say, you know, if you have legal access to a park and there's a trail, you know, 10 yards away, you know, people shouldn't have to look at that, in which case either drag it well out of sight or, you know, if practical, maybe bury it. Or if you're hunting on someone else's land, you know, and they've got a dog running around, you're not going to get invited back if that dog brings, you know, 4 feet of small intestine, you know, gets dragged in
right
through the front door.
Right.
So use a little bit of common sense there.
Right. So now you mentioned courses. Now, where do you teach your courses, and can you talk about the courses you do teach and the demographic of the people that take your courses?
Well, I live and teach just outside of Charlottesville, Virginia, which is about a little over 2 hours south of Washington, D.C. And the class that that I've taught for, you know, two or three for years now is just a guide to a beginner's introduction to hunting deer for food, and it's a 2-day course. I used to do it, you know, having a group that would meet for an hour or two every evening once a week, and which was great for locals who could, you know, we'd have these great groups that would come together. But after I started getting a lot of national attention for the class, I had people all over the country asking to take it, and so I had to compress it into just 2 days where people could come in for a weekend. I have a lot of people come from New York City, and I've had people come from other countries actually to do it. And it's a science class that happens to be about deer. I mean, we cover a lot of ecology, we cover a lot of ballistics, we cover evolutionary history of deer, we cover anatomy. And in the first day, we have a field trip out to a shooting range, and everybody learns how to shoot different types of rifles or whatever weapon's going to be appropriate for where they think they're going to hunt. And they learn basic gun safety, and they learn some basic marksmanship and find out what they're capable of, and maybe get an idea of what type of weapon's going to make sense for them, so they don't go out and buy something and find that they're overgunned, the gun doesn't fit them, it's too much recoil, or what have you. And you find out, you know, everyone goes home having, you know, some idea of how practical marksmanship. And then on the second day, we also I get a freshly killed, very fresh live deer. Well, it's not live anymore, but it recently was. And everybody learns, gets to take a hand in helping to gut and skin and butcher the deer. I rent a commercial kitchen, and we take the meat out there to do, you know, final butchering into discrete cuts of meat, and we cook it and eat it and serve it up with some wine, and everybody has a real good time. So that's the class that I teach most often. I also do a little bit. I also do a private instruction, working as a hunting tutor for deer and small game. That's for doves, squirrels, all sorts of things, which is a little bit like being a hunting guide. But most hunting guides will take you out, and you know they've got an area they've already scouted, and they're going to put you on a stand, say for deer, and they're going to say, "You sit here. We've already figured it out. There's a big deer that's going to come by here at a particular time, and you go get it." They've done the work, and they put you in the place where you need to be to pull the trigger. And so what I do as a guide is more of tutoring, where I'm more interested in teaching someone how to figure out where the animal will be, how to understand it, maybe work on their marksmanship a little bit, and teaching them how to read the terrain. And then when they finally do kill something, you know, I don't send them back to a lodge for martinis. You know, I have the student roll up their sleeves, and they learn how to butcher.
Right.
So that's the type of teaching that I've been doing. I also do workshops with there's an organization, I don't know if you're aware of, called Slow Food. It's an international organization. It started in Italy, and the idea is they're the antithesis of fast food. You know, they're preserving traditional food ways and traditional ingredients that maybe could get lost as we mechanize our food production more and more. And every few months, I would say I seem to do another slow food workshop in New York or Virginia, and that'll involve, you know, taking a wild ingredient and just doing a workshop, introducing people to, you know, this is how you break up a venison hindquarter, this is how to butcher a goose, and then we cook it, and explain to them how someone who's lived in a city all their life can start doing this as an adult. So those are the types of teaching that I've been doing.
This is a rebroadcast of Locavore from the CFRU archives. Locavore airs live every Thursday morning at 10:30 a.m. Stay tuned to CFRU 93.3 FM.
CFRU Archive.
Okay, and now, typically for a 2-day course, so how much, like, I'm just thinking of myself, it's very interesting. I don't know anybody who offers something like this up here in Canada, but if somebody from Canada wanted to come on down, because this is where our listenership is right now, I guess we're international too, being on the internet, how much would it cost them to come down for a couple of days to do the, I guess, is it a weekend course? Or?
Yeah, it's a weekend course, which I'm actually not able to do during the summer because it's too hot to have to get the fresh deer here.
Okay.
The only way, I've tried every which way of getting the deer transported or getting a fresh deer on the ground at the appointed time, because I can't have people coming in from out of state or out of their countries without and then have them show up and there's not a deer. We
right.
try it every which way. And so there's one deer farm in Virginia that I usually buy a deer from. And in the summertime, I can't transport it in here without it being spoiled. It's a couple hours drive, and I pay somebody to go and pick it up and kill it and bring it straight out here. And you know, in the summer, like today, it's 92 degrees here in Virginia,
yeah.
and the meat, it would spoil. We just can't do it in warm weather.
Right.
So when the weather cools down, we'll start doing them again. And it's usually about $380 for the 2-day class, and we have
mm-hmm.
a lot of different. I have staff to pay and so forth. It's not just me that does this.
Right.
I have a friend who is a primitive skills expert that co-teaches skinning, and he'll explain how to he'll bring leather goods he's made and explain how to preserve hides and tan them, and sometimes we'll have a chef to work with, and I have a co-instructor for the range session and so on, and that cost, it includes all ammunition, all materials, use of rifles and so forth.
So when people, if they come from Canada, have you had people from Canada come to take your courses?
I have. I have had at least two people come directly from Canada, and then a whole bunch more Canadian expats who've been living somewhere in the U.S.
Okay. Now, are there special permits they need, being non-U.S. Citizens, to take your course at all?
No, not at all. As long as they're law-abiding. I mean, I'm not selling them a firearm. You know,
okay,
there's no
right.
special. In Virginia, yeah, it's they don't need any kind of special permit. Because bear in mind, for the deer call courses, they are not going out on an actual hunt per se.
Okay.
I mean, we'll have up to 10 students in the class, and there's just no way to have. Also, that we'd be restricted to during the season. But they're learning all the different pieces. They learn how to shoot. They learn how to track. They learn how to understand what the deer is doing year round. They learn how to butcher. They learn all the different pieces. Although it's usually no great difficulty for a Canadian to get a U.S. hunting license.
Okay. You've talked about the slow food movement that you're involved with. Have any of your kills made it to the menu of restaurants, and do you think locavore hunted food can be marketed successfully on a restaurant menu?
Yeah, it can, and it has. What I've been doing hasn't been focused on market hunting per se for sale. I have had I've had kills that have been served at restaurants for special events where it wasn't sold, but was cooked in the kitchen and then used at a fundraiser or something. In the United States, we have a bit of a problem where anything that's sold, in any kind of meat that's produced and sold across state lines, we've got federal regulations that really don't make a lot of sense, that require that the animal have been killed and butchered in a USDA-approved slaughterhouse. So if a wild pig was killed in the field and then brought immediately to the slaughterhouse to be butchered, it can't be sold. It can be donated, it can be used in food banks, but it can't actually be sold for money. If it's all kept within the same state, then that is theoretically possible. If that's been done in Louisiana with Nutria, where that's been put on a lot of menus. And there's a little bit of a contradiction there, because with fish we can do that. And there are a lot of invasive fish that can be killed in the feed, can be killed on the boat and then served in restaurants. Lionfish is one species that has great potential for that, which is a problem on the on our Atlantic coast, all over the U.S. and in much of Canada also. We've got a big problem with Asian carp.
Right.
Which are just absolutely just destructive to the habitats they take over. There are stretches of the Missouri and Illinois River where 95% of the biomass is now carp, and there's no reason at all why that can't. In fact, there are some places where it's on some menus. There's no reason at all why we can't, up that even more and have people taking those and getting them served in restaurants. So it's happening bit by bit, but we've got regulatory things that are going to need to be changed, and I'm trying to get that done as well.
And the reason I'm interviewing you is because I heard you on another national Canadian radio program, and hosting the show like I have here, and being an advocate for the local food movement and people that grow and process local products or products as close to the point of consumption as possible. I thought, well, this is really interesting because, there's always this yin and yang between carnivores and vegetarians, I suppose. But at the same time, I think animals are part of a sustainable ecosystem. There are a lot of people that I think would support that idea. So
I've had a lot of vegetarians take the class, actually.
Yeah, that's...
I've had a vegan, actually, and she ate the meat. So
really?
Yeah.
So yeah, that must be interesting. Now, have people ever had, because it's wild game, and I know what you're talking about, no antibiotics, they're able to roam free, they have the natural biota, they have a natural intestinal flora, they're not stressed as much. But has anybody ever had a bad reaction to having something wild and consuming that, you know, as opposed to something that's, you know, not?
You mean in terms of like a health issue, like
a health issue,
or something like that?
Yes.
Nothing that I've never heard. The closest thing I could think of would be, you know, wild mushrooms. Well, that's not hunting, really.
Right.
There are some mushrooms that some people have a reaction to and others don't. No, I've never heard of anything you know like that. I mean, especially with I will say there may be some species out there that someone's intolerant to, and I haven't heard about it. But the stuff that people are most commonly hunting for food, I've never heard of anything like that happening. I mean, especially particularly with deer. When you're talking about deer, you know, they're eating a lot of the same stuff that cows are, especially if you hunt deer in cattle country, you know, they're grazing on the exact same stuff. But I've never heard of anybody having an adverse health reaction. If you had an animal, the only thing I could think of would be if you had an animal that somebody was trying to, that you had a rancher or someone from USDA that was poisoning to get rid of, and then you hunted the animal before it died and it still had some poison in the system. I mean, that's kind of a stretch. I'm sure that's happened somewhere.
This concludes part one of my interview with Jackson Landers, the locavore hunter. In part two, Jackson is going to recount a very exciting story of hunting for nutria in Louisiana amidst the water moccasins and the alligators. And we'll also get into the technical aspects and ethos of hunting for food locally. This is Walter Garrison, the host of Locavore, broadcast out of the studios of CFRU 93.3 FM, located in Guelph, Ontario. Thank you for listening, and remember, buy local.